Welcome back to the program. As the recession ends with a lot of wealth and privilege for people, we're going to talk about a particular group for whom wealth and privilege came to an end arguably some time ago, and that is the WASP elite. It is the subject of a memoir written by our guest this morning, Tad Friend. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he writes the magazine's Letter from California. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his memoir, Cheerful Money, Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor. Tad Friend, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. Explain, first of all, what the WASP elite was all about.
Well, the WASP elite, first of all, would probably not have referred to itself as the WASP elite, but they were basically the people who came over from England two or three or even four centuries ago and pretty much ran the country for 300-odd years without ever thinking of themselves as WASP. The name only really became sort of popular in 1964, at which point the WASPs themselves, while still around, and they're still, you can still see them, and they live in little enclaves here and there, but WASPs themselves were no longer running the country.
And how did they see themselves before they were identified as this particular elite, when they were, as you say, for 300-plus years running the country and business? How did they view themselves? How did they view their special place?
They, if you look, there's a lot of literature left by people. Robert Walker, who was a Secretary of State in the 19th century, said basically they viewed themselves as having been given a covenant by God to not only run America, but increasingly to run the world. So they had a sort of sense of a special mission, which could bleed into smugness, of course, and a kind of self-confidence that didn't admit of any kind of self-questioning. And I think this is the kind of thing that in my own family, which is what I write about, mm-hmm. came down where no one ever talked about us as WASP. No one ever said, you are special, you have a special mission, but you implicitly felt that you had been given all these things, a good education, a little bit of money, tradition, ratty old furniture, as a means towards doing something important.
And there was often a sense of obligation that went along with this.
There was, and, you know, the idea, I think the best parts of the WASP tradition, which still endure, are encourage people to, you know, give anonymous gifts to charities, to work on boards, to help out in the local town, to show up at the town meeting, all those kinds of things where you felt you had a duty to give back. The worst aspects of the tradition, many of which unfortunately showed up in my own family, encourage people to drink too much and to believe, I guess as Ann Richards famously said of George Bush the senior, that he was born on third base and thought he had a triple.
Right.
And there was a bit of a feeling that if you start off sort of at the top, it's very hard to have much ambition to go anywhere.
To what extent did some of this also come, though, from in addition to the privilege of birth and position, a kind of intellectual elite?
The WASP tended to be the elite in all areas. I mean, you don't think necessarily of Nathaniel Hawthorne and Mark Twain and Herman Melville as WASP, but of course they were. Looking backward retroactively, they didn't think of themselves that way. And just because those are mostly the people who were here until the great waves of immigration in the late 19th century, everyone was one kind of WASP or another. In my own family, it was taken for granted that everyone would go to Yale. That was just where you went. I didn't happen to, but I was causing a kind of mild undersea earthquake by going to Harvard, which was considered, pretty much as if I'd gone and joined the Merchant Marine.
To what extent was birth position and where you were born, where your family was, to what extent did that set the stage for the rest of your life?
You know, I think the book that I wrote is an attempt to grapple with that very question, which is, I think at a certain point, as I said earlier, no one ever said you're a WASP, but I think in college I began to realize there are lots of other kinds of people with different backgrounds, and they seem to me more interesting than the people I grew up with. And at that point, although it's a little bit too late to begin realizing who you are, because you are that person, you automatically write thank you notes, you keep your emotions to yourself and don't discuss them with people, you dress a certain way. And I think the sort of story of my life for the last 20 years or so is trying to kind of identify who I am so I can maybe try to change course, a little bit, and the biggest part of that, in my case, was spending 13 years sitting on a psychiatrist's couch talking to her about what it was all about.
Right. To what extent did the changes in society in the 50s and 60s, in a broader sense, precipitate the breakdown of this culture in many ways?
I think, well, in the book I argue somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but not really, that 1965 was a kind of watershed year, which was a few years after I was born, where sort of the old WASP hegemony in all ways of life kind of came to an end. And obviously that was precipitated earlier, and you could even argue going back to some of the changes that occurred in the 1920s and various colleges, where there were suddenly the WASPs who were in charge put in Jewish quotas because they were worried about suddenly they were going to be overrun by people from a different background. And then the Depression came along and wiped out a lot of wealth. And the World War II came along and changed a number of things, including taking away, you know, people who'd been the servants. They all went off to war and they came back, and suddenly sort of the way of life was different. I think everything that my parents grew up taking for granted, which was having people around who, you know, who were servants, that you wouldn't have to do your own cooking, that you wouldn't necessarily even have to do your own driving, that all sort of went out. By the time they got married in 1960, they had sort of no money and no servants and no idea of how to live their lives as adults.
But they still had a lot of influence. They still were in positions of power in many places.
Absolutely. You know, it's hard to, unless you have a revolution as you did in France, where you actually hunt people down and send them to the guillotine, which I'm not encouraging. You know, there's still plenty of WASPs around. I see them every day. Lots of them still have money. Lots of them still have influence. But if you look at say, the people who are in the cabinet in Washington, you don't see a whole lot of WASPs. And even if you look in the heads of large corporations, there are people like Jeff Bucus, who runs Time Warner. Mm-hmm. But by and large, you see people from other walks of life. So the money is kind of gradually diminishing, and the power is diminishing. And what's left is a certain amount of land and a lot of houses that are sort of gradually tumbling down around our ears.
Right. I mean, if we think about the 60s and the kind of best and the brightest at the time, that was kind of the apex of power and influence in many ways.
Yeah, it probably wasn't the, I wouldn't think of it as the apex, but so much as sort of the supernova of it, where it exploded, because the apex was really when it was totally taken for granted and everyone was that way. But it was written about, the reason they were called the best and the brightest, sort of ironically, by David Halberstam, is because it was all these people, you know, McGeorge Bundy and Dean Rusk and William Bundy and Robert McNamara, who had these privileged backgrounds, many of whom had gone to Yale and had been in Skull and Bones, the secret society, and whose family members had grown up expecting more or less that you would go to Yale, you would be in Skull and Bones, and then you'd work for the government. But that was the end of it, because suddenly everyone began to realize that these people who had been entrusted to run the country and would be assumed to know what would be best for us in a small, faraway country like Vietnam actually had very little idea what they were doing.
Talk a little bit about your own family and how it came to sort of lose its sense of power.
My own family, speaking of apogees, I guess probably reached an apogee at the turn of the 20th century. On my father's side, my great great grandfather James Woodfriend made a packet in coal and banking and money, and it would amount to about $350 million in today's money, which I hasten to add, none of which is left. And on my mother's side, there was sort of a group of very well-off kind of corporate lawyers and professors. So there was a sense that, you know, you lived in a nice house, you had servants, you had country clubs here and there. And I think gradually, on all wings of my family, those sort of shining examples of people who achieved and made money and had an impact on society gradually slipped away. My grandfather, my father's father, was a tremendous alcoholic, very nice man, got fired from his job in his mid-40s, mostly because he was encouraging his brokerage clients to invest in things that immediately went bankrupt. And he just had no idea of what the future held. I think the problem in my family growing up a little bit, my father is a historian, so it makes a certain amount of sense. But the problem in my family was that everyone was always looking backwards and trying to hold on to what we'd had, which included, you know, family houses and furniture and ideas of how to live a life. And no one was really looking forward, saying, this is where we should be going, this is where the country is going, what's next?
To the extent that part of that culture, as you talked about before, was not to complain, not to show emotion, to what extent was there resentment as this power waned, and how did it exhibit itself?
That's a great question, because I think it's hard to tell. You've nailed it perfectly, which is that one of the things that became a family watchword in my family growing up was my brother, when we were all young, one day exclaimed over my mom had cut a piece of cheesecake, and he said, I'm not going to complain, but I got the smallest piece. And we used to repeat that, because that was the idea, that you weren't explicitly allowed to complain or feel aggrieved at either the smallest piece of cheesecake or the vanishing slice of the American pie. But we did feel it. And, you know, there was always a sense of, you look back at family photos of these giant family compounds in Pittsburgh that my dad had grown up in. And also you look at even at the sort of family house out in Long Island and realize that the roof was falling in, and there was, you know, where was the money going to come from? But there was a sense of a little bit of kind of motiveless grievance, because you couldn't really complain. It wasn't like anyone was doing it to us. We were just not doing it for ourselves. And a larger sense of bewilderment. My great uncle, who was the head of the history department at Yale, was an extremely liberal man in many ways, liberal-minded, wrote a great book about Tocqueville, was a Democrat, except he was anti-Semitic in the way of his class, and sort of believed that in some secret way the Jews had come in and were eroding standards everywhere, and that was in some hard-to-explain way why, you know, we were on the run.
It's interesting that one of the things, and the period of time where this broke down, as you talk about, in the mid-60s, at the same time, the rise of kind of suburban culture, which in so many ways tried to be imitative of so many of the kind of WASP ideals.
Right. That's true. I think if you look at Mad Men, the show, that suburban culture in which neither Don Draper nor his wife Betty are really WASP, but they are living out a kind of WASP ideal in the Westchester suburbs of New York. And Digby Baltzel in his book, The Protestant Establishment, and also Nelson Aldrich in his book about old money, talk about how kind of the WASP idea fled to the suburbs. And, you know, some WASPs went there themselves, but also people who wanted to be like WASPs went there, where it was a place where you could get a purchase with less money and, you know, have a country club and sort of start the whole cycle over again.
Right, and the irony is that just as people would move to the suburbs and want to be like WASPs, was the same time that the core WASP identity and values were beginning to disintegrate.
Yeah. You know, there's that old Marx line that everyone loves to quote about how history repeats itself and the second time is as farce. I think I talk about that a little bit in the book and trying to talk about, you know, the enormous popularity of Ralph Lauren, for instance, is interesting just because he's codified a way of life that he didn't necessarily grow up with, and that WASPs themselves weren't necessarily living anymore. It's a bygone ideal. It's the 1920s and Tommy Hitchcock playing polo and jodhpurs, which no one really wears anymore. But that's the idea that you can sort of buy into.
How do you think your kids will understand that culture that they came from?
That's one of the jugular questions I tried to address in the book, because I kept kind of bringing them back in because I kept thinking about them. We have twins, and they're only 3 years old, so it's a little early, I think, for them to be grappling with the WASP heritage. But on the other hand, you know, I find myself torn. I wrote the book in part so that they would know, you know, where I'd come from and what it was like to be me, and I, in a way of kind of giving them a little shorthand about my life. And yet I don't want the heritage that I've had, which I felt burdensome at times, to be a burden on them. At the same time, as if they repudiate, you know, the way I grew up entirely, I'll feel hurt. And I guess I comfort myself thinking that mixed message is what parenting is all about. You inevitably send mixed messages, and I hope they'll somehow be able to take the good things, some sense of, you know, saying please and thank you at the very least, and not the bad things, which I felt the main thing I think my wife and I want is for them to feel that they can come to us with any issue, whether it's about drugs or sex or anger or loneliness or insecurity or all those emotional things that I never felt I could really talk about with my parents, and their parents, they didn't feel they could talk about with their parents, and to be able to bring those up with us and talk about them candidly. I think that would be the main thing I'd want to jettison from my own upbringing.
You talked about alcohol before, and certainly that's a big part of the culture. Talk a little bit about why you think that has been the case.
Well, I think it springs from the sort of famously tight-assedness of the WASP, in the sense that since emotions are discouraged, you need some sort of lubricant to be able to have a real conversation. And I think it was originally probably a way of, you know, just getting people to talk and be less stiff and uncomfortable. But it was the thing that I think I didn't, you know, by any modern standard, like all my grandparents were alcoholics, just because they drank so much just on a pure volume basis. They could have two or three cocktails before dinner, wine at dinner, and then a postprandial whatever, which would just make me lie down thinking of it. But only two of them were really kind of arguably alcoholics by the standards of their day, because everyone did that. They all were just used to doing it. It was just simply what you did, and the cliche about how you go to a WASP's house and the first thing they say is, you know, would you like a drink, is true, and there was a built-in culture that minimized the amount of drinking, which was no one ever said, can I get you another drink? It was always kind of refresh your drink, or would you like a dividend, or some way of masking what was actually going on, which is just the constant pounding of booze.
Mm-hmm. Again, like watching Mad Men.
Yeah, there's a lot to that. You watch those martini-fueled lunches, and I just think, every time I've ever had a drink at lunch, I have to immediately go to lie down, and I'm useless for the rest of the day. I just don't know how you do it unless you really, you know, toughen up your liver for years, which I guess they were doing.
Talk about the money and where the money went. You talk about in your own case how the money disappeared.
Yeah. Well, the I guess on a macro scale, taking my father's family, as I mentioned earlier, my great-great-grandfather had made it a packet of money. Then it gets, you know, split up. He got split up among his four children. So that then we're down from his $15 million inheritance to $4 million each, which is still great. But then none of them did anything. Three of them were women who just didn't work and spent the money on servants and maintaining their lifestyle. One of them did work but didn't work very hard. And he passed probably a million or two on to his son, my grandfather, who invested in things like Nerlep mines and Red Rock Cola and Hygienic Telephone, all of which companies immediately went bankrupt. So he had no sense of it, and he, you know, rather swiftly ran through what was left. And so it only took about really two generations for it to come down to pretty much nothing. When my parents got married, they didn't really have a whole lot of money. And in my own case, there's always a little more money than you think, because when people die, it turns out there was a trust, or there was a, you know, a nice piece of furniture that you can sell, or an old car or something. So I actually inherited some money from my father's mother, but I spent all of it and more on psychoanalysis to try to sort of get out from under the burden. So it kind of ended up as a kind of net-net wash on the money I inherited and the money I needed to understand my background.
Who were some of the WASP heroes?
Well, I think, you know, George Washington. we can claim him. You know, someone was pointing out to me recently that a lot of the venture capital, like people like in the Hewlett-Packard mm-hmm. world, that those are where WASPs are sort of now, you know, making an impact on society, that a lot of the venture capital firms in Silicon Valley are populated by WASPs. WASP would like to think of themselves as, you know, I have not yet begun to fight, that kind of WASP hero. But the people that I felt like, you know, we were brought up to admire, were sort of people who minded their own business in a strange way. Your heroism or your example was people who stuck to their knitting, didn't socialize too much, were very polite at all times, and didn't make waves. And, you were not necessarily supposed to go and be president of, you know, everyone always thinks they want their child to become president. I don't think that was the goal. My goal was more or less to keep things going, understand the family values and preserve them, and sort of not get into the newspaper too much.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, as a kind of method of raising your children, is not necessarily going to produce the next generation of leaders.
With all the inherent problems that we've been talking about, however, when you look at the lack of civility sometimes, the lack of politeness in our society today, there has to be some nostalgia, some positive nostalgia for all of this.
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying earlier when we were talking about my children, I do find myself, much as I hated being badgered to write thank you notes and to say please and to open the door for people and to share my toys when I was young, I find myself replicating the exact set of things with our children. Because I do find that, you know, even at the playground when some child barrels ahead of them in line, I find my, you know, hackles rising and I want to say, well, that's, you know, hey, stop that. And the extraordinary rudeness we see at the local playground is something my wife and I talk about both passionately and also with some sense of irony because we realize how ridiculously stodgy and caricature-like we end up sounding. But I do feel, you know, my mom always said, you know, people like to receive thank you notes, and I think much as I hated writing them, now that I'm on the receiving end every now and again, I think, you know, people do like to receive thank you notes. She was right about that. And so I do, you know, I think, unfortunately, like any sentence that begins with the decline of civility in America makes people roll their eyes because people have been talking about that literally since the 1830s. And some of the research I was looking at, people are complaining about the new rising class of, mm-hmm. you know, swells who paid no attention to the old decorum. So it's you know, we've been getting worse and worse for centuries, in theory. But I think it's inevitable that you can't help but admiring people who don't bother you. And particularly living as I do in New York City, where the great code of behavior is never to meet anyone else's eyes on the subway because that person is possibly crazy. And just to sort of exude a kind of cocoon around yourself of, I am not going to bother you, don't bother me. You know, WASP manners and mores have a certain place.
Tad Friend, the book is Cheerful Money, Me, My Family, and the Last Days of WASP Splendor, just published by Little Brown. Tad, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
I enjoyed it. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.